need your help to do it. Despite their lack of interest, both children were good helpers and snapped to attention now that they were needed. Get your shoes on, then come back here and I'll tell you what I need you to do. When the kids returned, Ellen had a ring of keys and an LED flashlight. The first thing Dad said we needed to deal with is the freezer. We're going to duct tape the lid down and we're going to stay out of it. If we run the generator a couple of hours a day, it'll keep things frozen. We'll eat the food from the refrigerator first, then if the power isn't back on, we'll start eating items from the freezer. Before the kids would go in the basement, they each went to their rooms to retrieve their headlamps. Jim insisted that they always have a working headlamp in their room so that they were never at the mercy of darkness. You never knew when the power would go out, or when you would have to get up in the middle of the night for some reason. Once the kids were glowing with their headlamps, they went down into the basement. They both had always thought the basement was a little creepy. Ellen didn't have any particular reservations about it. After all, the basement held the wood stove that kept their house nice and toasty for free. The basement was Jim's domain, though, and it was odd to be down here without him. Looking around, she saw his stuff everywhere, except for the pile of dirty laundry by the washer. She supposed that the generator would run the washer, but she wasn't sure what would happen when the fuel was gone. Except for an antique washboard in one of the storage buildings, they had no good backup plan for washing clothes. While Ariel held Ellen's flashlight, Pete tore off strips of duct tape and handed them to Ellen. Ellen went around the perimeter of the freezer lid until it was sealed securely. "There," she announced when they were done. "Are we done now?" Ariel asked. "No," Ellen said. "We're just getting started. Besides, it's not like you can watch television anyway. You might as well be helping me." They went outside to an older storage building that was used for yard tools, mowers, chainsaws, and spare lumber. Ellen unlocked the padlock and swung open the plywood double doors. Hanging from a hook just inside the door was a thick extension cord about 10 feet long. She knew it was the cord for the generator because Jim had drilled it into her head frequently. In his attention to detail, he had also attached a plastic tag to it that labeled it for generator use. She removed the cord from the nail and passed it to Ariel. "Take this over by the basement door and wait on us." "It's heavy," Ariel said, staggering exaggeratedly under the weight. Ellen climbed into the building. She tried lifting the wheelbarrow handles of the generator, but it was extremely heavy. She couldn't get it herself, so Pete climbed in to help. Together, they lifted, then wheeled the beast over to the door and carefully guided it down the ramp to the yard. "That's heavy," Pete said. "I know," Ellen said, wiping her forehead. "And we have to get it over there beside the basement door." They each took a handle, lifted, and guided the generator the 40 feet or so to the back of the house. It was slightly uphill to their destination, and they groaned and panted with the effort. There was a little alcove created by an addition near the covered entry to the basement. In this alcove was a transfer switch. When the generator was plugged into the transfer switch, it allowed Jim to safely power 10 priority circuits in the house without danger of feeding power back into the grid or starting a fire. Ellen and Pete were huffing and puffing when they finally reached the back of the house. "We need to get more exercise," she told Pete. "We're getting it now," he groaned. "Here's the cord, Mommy," Ariel said, extending it to Ellen. Ellen took the cord and plugged one end into the transfer switch and the other into the generator. "Are we going to start it now?" Pete asked. Ellen shook her head. "No, we'll wait for 4 hours," she said. "Since the power just went off, everything is still cold now." "Are we done yet?" Pete asked. "No," Ellen said. "You'll be done when I say you're done. I need you two to help me and quit asking if we're done all the time. You might have to work all day, and if you do, you'll just have to get over it. So quit asking." Ellen didn't often snap at them like that. She usually had infinite patience. She was worried, though. Worried about Jim, and worried if she could do this without him. "What do you need me to do next?" Pete asked, tears in his eyes. Ellen hugged him, pulling Ariel into the hug, too. We need to find the little red box that Daddy uses to pump up your bike tires and jumpstart the mower. I know where that is, Ariel exclaimed.
Where?
Pete asked.
In the Daddy Shack.
The Daddy Shack was the newest storage building. It was a large, organized building where Jim stored bicycles, kayaks, camping gear, and fishing supplies. He was particular about this building, and that was why they called it the Daddy Shack. The three of them walked over to the shack, and Ellen studied her key ring.
It's the silver key, Ariel told her confidently.
How do you know that? Ellen asked.
Because I asked him, Ariel replied. He told me it was the silver key with the square top.
Ellen looked and found a key that fit that description. She tried it, and sure enough, it worked.
Very good, Ariel.
Ariel beamed. Sitting just inside the door was the red box they were looking for. It was a wagon power dome, a rechargeable device that could boost a car battery or pump up a tire. It also had an inverter that would allow users to operate a 110-volt device. There was also a USB port that would accept USB chargers for phones or tablets. Jim had sung the praises of this device every time he used it. Ellen hoped that she and the kids had paid enough attention to be able to operate it.
Pete, go get the mower and trailer. We'll need it to haul the things we need out of here, Ellen said.
Pete walked off, always anxious for an opportunity to demonstrate his skills at operating the mower. He was proud of the fact he'd recently learned to back up a trailer, which was something Ellen certainly couldn't do. While Pete was gone, Ariel and Ellen went inside the building. Ellen opened a tall plastic Rubbermaid cabinet and examined the contents. Inside were cans of Coleman fuel, green 1-pound propane canisters, isobutane canisters, and various boxes with writing on them listing the contents. Ellen took out 2 propane canisters and handed them to Ariel.
Set these by the door, she said.
Then she moved to a plastic tote of camping supplies and removed the lid, taking out a Coleman propane lantern and handing it to Ariel, who dutifully stashed it beside the door. Ellen then removed some battery-operated camping lanterns of various sizes. She and Ariel piled them by the door as well. While Pete backed the mower up to the door and killed the engine, Ellen spotted the camping stove.
"Come help me with this, Pete," she said.
She and Pete struggled to pull the camping stove off the shelf and set it on the floor. Jim had told them that he knew food was the way to keep them interested in camping when they first started going. So instead of just using a stove, he bought a propane stove and oven combination that allowed them to cook pizzas, chicken nuggets, biscuits, and cinnamon rolls when they camped. It kept everyone happy. Though the oven was fueled by green propane canisters, she knew Jim had recently bought an attachment that allowed him to fuel it with the larger tank from the gas grill. If she could figure out how to connect the other tank, then they could run the stove for longer. Jim had dozens of the small tanks, but those would run out eventually if this emergency stretched on. Ellen looked around at the impressive pile of gear, thinking of all the camping trips they'd been on. She'd never been camping before she married Jim. She wasn't even sure if she'd like it. But when the children were out of diapers, Jim wanted to get them interested in the outdoors. They started with short hikes and fishing trips before working their way up to an overnight camping trip. For their first, Jim took them to a nearby state park with fishing and a swimming beach. He wanted to stay close to home in case the trip was an utter failure and they had to pack up and go home. It wasn't, though. They had a great time and started many of the camping traditions that they still practiced, like Jim hiding an emergency bag of Oreos in the camping gear. From that first overnight, they moved to weekend trips, and eventually to trips that spanned several weeks. Just last summer, they'd gone to Acadia National Park in Maine and biked, kayaked, and hiked it, and Ellen thought it was the best time of her entire life. From there, they'd driven through New Hampshire and Vermont and spent another week camping at Vermont State Parks, fishing and kayaking a new pond every day.
"Let's get this out of here," she said with a big sigh.
She and Pete struggled to get the stove into the mower trailer. Then they formed a human chain with Ellen in the building, Pete at the trailer, and Ariel in the middle, and loaded the 1-pound propane canisters, the power dome,
the lanterns, and a few other odds and ends she'd found in the camping box. When she stepped out of the building, Ellen made sure that she locked both of the buildings up. She directed Pete to drive the mower over to the back porch for unloading, and she and Ariel walked over to meet him there. The back porch was covered and screened in. She could use the camp stove there since it was well ventilated. When they were done shifting their load onto the back porch, they all took seats at the patio table. "Well, I forgot something," Ellen said. "We need to hook up some batteries to that solar charger."
"What's that?" Ariel asked.
"Daddy said he had a charger in the building that you could set in the sun, and it would charge a boat battery," Ellen explained.
"Oh, yeah," Ariel said. "It's hanging from a nail just inside the door. The batteries are in the old building with the mower. They're under the shelves."
"How do you know all this?" Ellen asked, surprised again.
"Daddy showed me," Ariel said proudly.
"I'm glad he showed you," Ellen said, "and I'm glad you paid attention."
"I always pay attention," Ariel said.
The three of them walked back to the storage buildings, and Ellen unlocked the doors again. While Pete struggled to get out the 3 12-volt marine batteries from one building, Ariel and Ellen went inside the other to retrieve the solar charger. It was exactly where Ariel said it would be. Reading the simple instructions, Ellen attached the alligator clips to one of the batteries and then laid the solar panel where it would catch optimal direct sunlight. "It'll be your job to charge these batteries, Pete," Ellen said. "We'll let this one charge all day tomorrow. Then you'll need to take off these clips and move them to the next battery, making sure you put the red clip on the post with the plus sign and the black clip on the post with the minus sign."
"Got it," he said.
"Now let's go get a drink," she said. "I'm thirsty." Ellen went and filled glasses with ice water for all of them. Since they still had ice, she went ahead and used it, but she turned off the ice maker when she was done. Once this ice was gone, it would not refill. Without power, they still had what water remained in the pressure tank in the basement, but the well pump would not run unless the generator was running. Water did not concern her much. She had hundreds of gallons stored for emergencies. They had cases of bottled water and dozens of gallon milk jugs that Jim had rinsed and refilled with water. He'd also accumulated a significant number of 2-liter soft drink bottles that they'd cleaned and refilled with water. Then there was the springhouse nearby, which provided a constant supply of clean, cool water. Jim had installed a gravity filtering system, so they could turn on a tap and fill bottles with filtered and immediately drinkable water. As Ellen was gathering the 3 plastic cups to deliver to the porch, there was a knock on the front door. It startled Ellen, and she nearly dropped the cups, managing to spill water on the floor and her shoes. Although they never had unannounced visitors on their property, Ellen would not normally have been struck with such fear by that sound. However, in her heightened state of stress and paranoia, the sound gripped her heart with cold fingers. She immediately realized that the gun Jim had told her to take with her to the store was still in her purse, which was still in her car. There were other guns, but they were put away and not immediately within reach. She had become too comfortable and forgotten the situation around them. She knew that she was going to have to go look out the window and see who this was. She also knew that things were going to have to change around here for the short term. Until Jim came back, they were going to have to keep some weapons closer at hand. She could not get caught like this again. She placed the cups back on the counter and moved to the living room, stepping as quietly as possible. She leaned toward the door and placed her eye to the peephole, her heart pounding in her ear. It was Henry, a neighbor that owned the farm next to their property. She relaxed and reached to unlock the front door. As her hand moved to the deadbolt, she realized that the door wasn't even locked. They would have to be more diligent. Jim usually took care of these things for them, kept them safe. With him not here, she was going to have to step up to the plate and start thinking like him. She swung the door open and plastered a smile on her face. She pushed the screen door open and Henry stepped back.
"Hey, Henry," she said. "How's it going?"
"Oh, fine," he said. "I was just checking my cows and wanted to make sure you guys were okay. Jim told me he was going to be out of town.
I noticed he hadn't got back yet.
She could hear a lot of unsaid sentiments in his few words. She knew he was thinking that it might be hard for Jim to make his way back home, that things were dangerous and Jim could be injured or killed trying to get home. She couldn't go there. She couldn't think that way. If anyone could make it through this, Jim could, she knew.
"He got trapped in Richmond," she said. "I started home but ran into trouble getting gas. I've had trouble reaching him except for a couple of short texts. I know he's trying to get home, but we just don't know when he'll get here."
"Things may get tough," Henry said. "We're pretty set, Henry," she said. Jim was pretty paranoid about this kind of thing already. He made preparations. Henry smiled. "That's good to know," he said. "Just keep your eyes open and your doors locked."
She realized that Henry had heard the door open without being unlocked.
"I will," she said.
"Heard of any trouble out there?"
"Lots of trouble," Henry said, shaking his head. "My only worry back here where we live is that big old trailer park."
She knew the one. While Henry's farm was beside their house, his own home was about 2 miles down the road. About halfway between them was a trailer park with about 20 older trailer homes.
"What worries you about that?" she asked.
"They're already out of water," he said. "Their water came from a well, and with no power, they've got no water. I'm pretty sure that none of them have any food storage. Won't be long before they're out prowling around trying to see what they can find or steal."
The thought chilled her.
He was exactly right. There were several houses between her and the trailer park, but they would probably eventually make it up this way.
"There's a lot of rough people living there," she commented. "Druggies and drunks."
Henry just nodded.
"Yep."
"We'll keep an eye out, Henry," she said. "Thanks for checking on us."
"No problem," he said. "Jim'd do the same if things were the other way around. If you need us, we use Channel 10 on the farm. I know Jim had some of those little walkie-talkies like we use because he called me on them before. If you've got batteries, you should just keep one of those things on all the time, set to Channel 10. That way we can let you know if there's anything you need to be aware of."
"That's a good idea, Henry," she said. "I know where those are, but I didn't think about it."
Henry smiled and waved, then stepped off the porch. He strode across the yard and climbed onto a big orange Kubota tractor with a haymower attached to it. Disaster or not, a farmer had to work. When Henry pulled away, Ellen walked to her vehicle and retrieved her purse. She removed the pistol, tucked it in her jeans pocket, and then locked her car. When she returned to the house, she closed the front door and made certain that it was locked.
Chapter 8.
As we approached the off-ramp and began to walk down the exit, I could see more concentrated activity than I'd seen in a while. There were a couple of chain hotels, a few fast-food restaurants, and two convenience stores with gas pumps off the exit. There were also a lot of cars and a lot of people. From the moment we started down the ramp, the shoulder was packed with a disorderly line of vehicles. There were also vehicles stopped in the middle of the traffic lanes at the bottom of the exit, and even more packing the parking lots of the restaurants and convenience stores. Some people sat around their vehicles like it was a tailgate party. It would have been festive if not for the undercurrent of desperation. In the distance, I could see a line of several large white tents with people gathered around them. People were friendlier here, though reserved. We nodded and greeted the stranded travelers we passed. They nodded and greeted us back. After all, we shared a common dilemma. At the bottom of the ramp, we turned right and walked past a fast food restaurant with a parking lot full of cars. A lot of people were eating ice cream. A woman holding the hand of a child walked out of the restaurant parking lot. I looked at the little girl's ice cream-smeared face and smiled. She smiled back. "They're giving away ice cream," she said.
"Well, that sounds delicious," Rebecca groaned. "I'm starving."
"What's going on at those tents?" I asked the woman.
"Some church," she said. "They're cooking food for stranded people." About that time, the smell of grilling burgers hit me. "That's where I'm headed," I said. I thanked the lady and looked at the faces of my group. No argument or discussion was needed. They were all as ravenous and thirsty as I was. It was amazing what food did for people. All of the people we passed on the way to the tents were stranded travelers with no idea how they were getting home or what they would even be going home to. But with a full plate of food, they were all smiles, awash in blissful ignorance. People greeted us in a friendly manner, as if we were at some outdoor festival. When we finally arrived at the tents, we were met with more smiling faces. "Lay down your burdens and eat with us," said a man with a ministerial bearing and perfect dark hair. He wore shorts and a blue polo shirt, and spread his arms toward the bounty of the tables laden with all manner of picnic foods. There were grilled burgers, hot dogs, and barbecue sandwiches, coleslaw, baked beans, chips, potato salad, cookies, pies, cakes, and much, much more. It was a beautiful sight. Even with my usual suspicion toward churches and organized religion, I was not about to turn down their charity. I took a styrofoam plate from a smiling woman and began filling it. Even as I appreciatively heaped food on my plate, I could not help but be aware that the generosity I was seeing was both an indication of very poor planning and possibly even a suicidal gesture for these friendly folks. These people didn't understand that they might not be able to replace the food they were giving away, assuming that in a day or two there would be more trucks of food showing up at their local grocery store and that the power would be back on. It was quite possible that this would not be the case. It could be months before we saw things restored to normal, maybe even longer. The very food that they were giving away might mean the death of their own families in a few weeks when the food supply dried up. It was already cooked and waiting, though, so I was not about to voice my concerns. With my plate so full it was about to collapse under the weight, I found a shady spot under a nearby tree and slid my pack to the ground. I went back and took two bottles of icy cold water from a cooler under the tent and was already eating when my fellow travelers joined me. "Make sure you save all your water bottles," I told them. "We may need to refill and reuse them if we have to walk." "I hope we don't have to walk," Randy said. "My feet are not used to this. What did we just walk, 10 or 12 miles, 15? "A little over 4, I said, my mouth full. Randy groaned. "I guess we'll just have to see what tomorrow brings," Alice said, digging into a hot dog. The plastic-haired minister approached and stood over us while we ate. "I know you folks have your mouths full, so I won't bother you much," he said. "But may I ask where you folks are headed?" Gary took a drink, cleared his throat, and replied, our default spokesman in this kind of situation. He was probably the best man for it, too, with a more agreeable disposition than I. "We left Richmond this morning, headed for Russell County," he said. The minister gave a low whistle as he considered this. "I've never been there," he said, "but I know it's a far piece. How many miles are you talking?" "Over 200 miles from here," Gary said. The minister shook his head. "Any idea how you're going to get there?" Gary shook his head. "Don't know yet. We just left our vehicle behind a couple of hours ago. We're hoping to find a place for the night and then see what tomorrow brings."
"The last town we stopped in was not this friendly," Rebecca commented. "We appreciate the hospitality."
"I'm afraid this town isn't much friendlier," the minister said with a little regret in his voice. "You can't see it from here, but they have a roadblock just over the hill there, and they're not letting anyone into town either. They agreed to let us come out to try and ease the suffering of you weary travelers. They did warn us that we couldn't bring anyone back with us, though. Otherwise, we'd open our church as a shelter, as the Lord would have us do." I wondered if the minister threw in that last part to deter us from asking for shelter for the night.
"What's the latest news? Heard anything?"
I asked between bites of baked beans.
"Pakistani terrorists have taken credit, is what I last heard," the minister said. "A lot of the terrorist attacks took place in remote areas, so the full effect isn't known yet. The news is getting kind of spotty, and it sounds like there isn't much official information coming in. I think the power outages and fuel shortages are starting to interfere with getting the news out.
Whatever's happening is nothing that we can't make it through. People must not lose hope. In that last sentence, I could hear that this minister believed this might be as bad as it got. I knew this area received its fair share of ice storms, and people here were used to power outages with downed trees and impassable roads. Perhaps that was what he was expecting from this, nothing more than an ice storm's level of inconvenience.
"What about the gas situation?" Gary asked.
"Well, not good," the minister replied. "What news you can get says they've hit pipelines and refineries, as well as destroying large quantities of the available gas supply stored at those refineries. They don't know when we'll be able to start buying gas again. Some say it could be months. They're telling people to conserve what gas they have because it may be all they get for a while. Most of my folks serving the food here walked or came on bikes. We used ATVs to bring the food."
"If they're not selling gas, why aren't there any guards at the gas stations we just passed?" I asked.
"The last station we stopped at up the road had troopers show up to make sure no gas was being sold."
"Well, there's no gas here to guard," the minister said. "All the tanks sold out this morning. I think there's a little kerosene left, and that's it."
"Are the hotels accepting guests?" Alice asked.
"Well, I think so," he said. "There's a rumor that FEMA is supposed to charter some buses and come through and deliver people down the interstate. One rumor is that they'll bus people closer to home. Another says they'll bus them to FEMA camps to sit out the worst of this. Because of that, a lot of people are just sitting around waiting for the buses to show up. Some have checked into the hotels. They don't have power, and I'm sure the water is probably down to a trickle by now, but I guess it beats sleeping in the bushes."
At the mention of FEMA, I caught Gary's eye and fought back a grin. While we were both a little paranoid, FEMA inspired severe paranoia in many in the prepper community. They were attributed with all manner of powers specifically tailored to taking our liberties. FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security were alleged to be evil incarnate.
"Are people behaving themselves?" I asked.
"There are a lot of people here." The minister considered this. "They are for now," he said after a moment, "because they think buses are coming to get them. When it gets dark and there are no buses, I'm not sure how they'll act. Not everyone has the means to pay for a hotel, even if they're accepting plastic. There have also been a lot of folks purchasing alcohol from the convenience stores and sitting around drinking it since they don't have anything else to do. We tried to discourage that by saying we wouldn't serve anyone who was intoxicated, but some prefer the bottle to the burger. I agree that things might not be so pretty here when people realize that the rumor was just that," I said. "When people get desperate, they get ugly."
"Yes," Alice agreed. "We've seen that today already."
"You folks have seen the face of man's ugliness today?" the minister asked. "We lost a member of our group this morning, and it's still upsetting to us," I said.
"Well, I'm sorry if I've hit a sore spot," the minister said.
"I do a lot of spiritual counseling, and prying is in my nature."
"That's okay," I said. "No harm done. We definitely appreciate the hospitality."
"You're most welcome," the minister said. "I see more hungry folks coming, so I better get back to the serving line."
"Sir," I said, "one more thing."
He turned back around.
"Yes?"
"You mentioned ATVs," I said. "We passed an elderly couple about 2 miles north of here on the interstate. They were out of gas, and the woman was in medical distress, unable to walk. Do you think that someone might be able to go pick them up and bring them back here? I'm really concerned about them."
"I'm sure that we could," the minister said. "We have a side-by-side ATV that holds 3 people and has a cargo bed. We also have a trailer attached to it."
"I would be glad to go with you," I added. "We hated to leave them, but we couldn't carry them without a vehicle of some sort."
"Why don't you folks go see if you can secure a hotel room after you're finished eating," he said. "Come back here in about 30 minutes, and I'll have someone available to pick them up if you can show us where they are."
"I appreciate that," I said. The minister smiled, turned, and walked back to his station, patting shoulders and greeting more hungry faces. We decided to start with the hotel farthest from the interstate. We'd had a short discussion about it, and Gary pointed out that it was likely to be the least crowded, since tired travelers would probably stop at the first hotel they came to. We walked in that direction, passing the second convenience store. As the minister had mentioned, there was a lot of drinking going on in the parking lot. Most people there appeared to be part of two large groups. One was made up of what looked like young rednecks in tank tops and ball caps, hanging around a cluster of pickup trucks with fishing poles and canoes in the beds. The other group was primarily Hispanic, chugging 40-ounce beers and casting hairy eyeballs toward the rednecks. Both groups were playing music from car stereos, running down the batteries of already dead or nearly dead vehicles. In the battle between Lynyrd Skynyrd and Latin hip-hop, it seemed like hip-hop was winning. There was some evident hostility there, too, that went beyond the battling tastes in music. Who knew what insults may have been cast back and forth over the course of this drunken day? I knew things like this didn't end well. Someone would be hurt before the night was over. Eyes cut toward us as we moved along down the road. No comments were made, though, so we kept faces forward and walked straight to the Comfort Inn. I'd had my share of altercations for the day. As we neared the hotel, we could see people hanging around outside the entryway. Kids played in the parking lot, made safer by the absence of moving vehicles. Some of the folks drank from water bottles, beer bottles, or red plastic cups. It was an odd environment, and in its atmosphere and informality was more like approaching a backpacker's hostel in a trail town than a chain hotel by the side of an interstate highway. We wove through the milling people and entered the dark, humid lobby. Light entering through the large picture windows revealed a tired Pakistani woman in a sari sitting on a stool at the counter. Rather than greeting us or asking us what we needed, she just stared apprehensively in our direction. "We're looking for rooms," Alice said, taking the lead and approaching the woman. "I'm assuming that you're open to guests?" The woman looked us over. "Can you pay?" she asked. "No free rooms." "We can pay," Alice responded, "as long as you still take credit cards." The woman shook her head. "Cards no good," she said. "Cash only." Alice was visibly frustrated by this. "We work for a government agency," she said. "Our cards are good." "No matter," the lady said. "Processing is down. Cash only." "You could write the information down off our cards and bill them later," Rebecca suggested helpfully. The woman's head shook rapidly, and she began muttering before Rebecca was even done. "No, no, no," she said adamantly. "Cash only, or go away." "How much are rooms?" Alice asked. $200 cash for a room," the lady responded. "For 20, you can sleep in hall or lobby." These were rooms that were probably $58 a night before the shit hit the fan. "Does anyone have $1,000 cash?" Alice said quietly, turning back to us. As usual, I could not restrain myself. "You've got to be kidding me. If I had $1,000 cash on me, I would not spend it on a night in a hotel. There could be more pressing needs before this trip is over." Alice frowned at me. "I guess we share," she said. "Do we all just want to put in 40 each and share a room?" Everyone coughed up $40, and Alice handed it to the lady across the counter, who handed her back a plastic key card. "Does this still work?" Alice asked, looking at the card. "Batteries still work," the lady responded. "Card will work. Water does not, though. You have to make pee outside in bushes." "Great," Randy said. "Probably 300 people here, and I think I saw 2 bushes out there." "More bushes out back," the desk clerk offered helpfully. I elbowed Randy. "It's a new hotel, too," I pointed out. "The bushes aren't really even leafed out fully yet." "Great," she sighed. "Is the kitchen serving anything?" Gary asked. The lady nodded. "Bar open, kitchen open, cash only." "Of course," Alice muttered. "Cash only." We made our way up to the third floor in a stairwell that was dimly lit by small windows spaced throughout. When we entered the third floor hallway, we found a scene much like the one we left behind this morning. A dim hallway, strangely silent. Without the HVAC system working its miracle, the hallway was musty. It was also clear from the smell of the hallway that not everyone was utilizing the bushes. The hallways stank of unflushed toilets and urine. Our room was equally musty, but was well lit and had opening windows that allowed us to bring in a little fresh air. It was also clean, apparently unused since the disaster. We crowded into the small room with two double beds, standing around awkwardly. All of us wanted to sit down on the nearest bed, but we didn't have a protocol for this. It was way too awkward.
"I'm sure it's fine with Jim and I if you guys take the beds. We'll sleep on the floor. Work for you, Jim?"
I nodded. "Not a problem." "Are you going to go back after those older folks?" Alice asked me. "Who all's going?"
"I don't think we all need to go," I said. "I think if Gary and I went and the church sends someone, that should be enough."
"If you're sure," Alice said, "I don't mind going."
"It should be fine," I said. "I just need to shift a few things in my pack." I tried to decide if I was going to take my pack with me on this little errand or leave it in the hotel room. As much as I was ready to have the heavy, sweaty thing off my back, I was also afraid to leave it. What if I didn't make it back here for some reason? What if it was stolen? The idea of making it through this crisis without my gear was not encouraging. I put too much planning into this get-home bag to step out of this room without it. I also wanted to switch pistols. While the Ruger LCP was my primary carry pistol due to its light weight and the fact that it was easily concealable, I carried a larger pistol in my get-home bag. It was a Beretta 92 9mm with fixed sights. Although it was not the first gun I'd ever owned, it was the first gun I ever went out and bought with my own money. I'd just gotten my first full-time job and wanted a handgun. Concealed carry permits were difficult to obtain at the time. You had to go before a judge and present a damn good reason for needing one. My reason for needing one, I felt, was that I'd traveled a lot at odd hours on lonely highways and didn't want to be caught unprepared. For 20 years, that gun had been my constant travel companion. It didn't have an accessory rail or tritium sights or a laser, but it was dependable and comfortable in my hand. I knew it intimately, and it was the pistol I wanted in my belt. I took a flashlight from my pack and disappeared into the bathroom. I shifted a few things around, tucking away some extra water bottles I'd brought from the church tent. I also removed my other pistol from the pack. When my adjustments were complete, I had the heavier Beretta concealed in a Phobos paddle holster under my untucked shirt. I also had two spare magazines for the pistol and a magazine holder on my left hip. Everything was hidden but easily accessible. When I exited the bathroom, I had the Ruger LCP in my hand. Rebecca stared at it. I looked at Randy. "You ever shoot one of these?" I asked, holding up the LCP. She smiled. "Oh, hell yeah. I've shot guns my entire life." "Keep this in your pocket until we get back," I instructed her. "If there's an emergency, use it. I just reloaded it. There's no safety, so when you pull it out, just point it and pull the trigger." "I fired guns, too," Alice said. "You could have left it with me." "I was afraid you might not give it back, Alice. Policy violation, you know."
"So you brought two guns?" Rebecca asked. "Why in the hell would you take two guns on a business trip?"
"One is a pocket gun," I said. "I carry it every day."
"Hopefully not to the office," Alice commented.
"We have a policy against that," I cut in. "I know. The Beretta is the gun I carry in my pack for real emergencies, Rebecca, like the one we're experiencing now. The events of today should clearly explain just why in the hell I would carry two guns on a business trip."
I turned back to Randy. "Do not wave that thing around as a threat. People may try to steal it if they see it. Only pull it out if you're fully intent on killing someone. Do you understand?" Randy nodded.
"You really think she'll need that thing?" Rebecca asked. "We're in a hotel room."
"I don't know if she'll need it or not," I said. "I want you guys to have it if you do need it. There's a parking lot full of drunks. The food and alcohol is going to run out soon, and tensions will flare up out of nowhere. Anything could happen."
Rebecca rolled her eyes at me and lay back on the bed.
"I think I'm going to take a nap," she said. "I think you guys are getting a little too gung-ho." I couldn't hold back a smirk.
"You do that," I told her. "Take a nice long nap and have sweet dreams. Maybe something with unicorns."
I shouldered my pack.
Gary?
I'm ready.
Chapter 9 30 minutes later, we were speeding up the shoulder of the northbound lane of the interstate in a Polaris Ranger with a retired insurance salesman named Emmett. It was a newer side-by-side ATV that seated 4 people. Behind us, we pulled a utility trailer. Although we'd not seen any traffic on the highway, we stayed to the shoulder to avoid being run down by a fast-moving semi or military convoy. This was something that would have been illegal yesterday, but today was of little consequence. We reached the stranded elderly couple, and Emmett swung around and drove across the median. Another action we probably wouldn't have taken yesterday. We pulled in behind the stranded car and stopped. Jack was sitting on the ground beside his wife, leaned back against the car, and looking a little more disheveled than when I'd seen him earlier. At first I thought they may be dead, but he rose awkwardly and stretched his back. He tried to smile, but appeared worried. I was glad he wasn't dead. I would have felt pretty shitty about him dying while I was enjoying my cheeseburger and baked beans.
"Howdy, friend,"
he said, his voice raspy.
"You remembered us."
I nodded to him and handed him another water bottle. "Hey, Jack, you look like you need this. How's Ruth?"
"I'm not really sure if she's asleep or unconscious," he said. "She went to sleep, and I haven't been able to wake her. She's still breathing, though, best I can tell."
I crouched by Ruth and placed the back of my hand against her cheek. Her skin was warm and clammy. Emmett came up behind me and assessed the situation.
"She all right? She doesn't look so good."
I shook my head. "I don't know. Let's just get her back and see what we can do for her." The three of us loaded her onto the utility trailer. The trailer had a tarp on it, held down by a few odd tent poles and a framing hammer. We shifted a few items to make her as comfortable as possible on the tarp. After getting her settled, we all returned to the front of the ATV while Jack retrieved a few items from his car. Digging in the back seat, Jack removed his wife's purse and a suitcase. When he locked up the car, he paused for a moment, staring at it from end to end.
"Not sure what the hell will happen to all these cars," he said to no one in particular. "Hell of a thing leaving them all out here sitting by the road. A lot of money to leave abandoned."
Jack turned to walk back to us, then stopped and stared past us to a point somewhere behind the ATV and trailer. Gary, Emmett, and I turned to see what he was staring at. From nowhere, a couple had appeared and were standing at the end of the trailer, staring down at Ruth. The girl appeared to be in her 20s, mousy, with long stringy hair that needed washing. She had a lot of sores on her face and was chewing on a fingernail with rotted teeth, staring at Ruth's inert body. The man with her appeared to be a little older. He wore a dirty white T-shirt, and his bare arms were covered with crude jailhouse tattoos. Names, words, crosses. He needed a shave, and probably a bath, too. He looked us over, squinting against the sun. The girl continued staring at Ruth, not making eye contact with us. She seemed a little out of it. When we didn't offer a greeting, the man broke the ice.
"We were on our way to the clinic and run out of gas," he said.
I stared back at him, trying to get a read on him. I saw no weapon, but it was hard to gauge a person's level of desperation. He could have been hiding a gun, a knife, or even a length of rebar. With no traffic and no access to law enforcement, any encounters people had on the highway were subject to completely random and Darwinian forces. Those who survived had to be quicker, sneakier, more paranoid, or better armed than those they ran into. "We're in the same boat," I finally said. "We can't get gas either." Emmett spoke up from the seat of the Polaris.
"One of you folks sick?" he asked.
"Sick?" the man replied, confused. "The clinic," Emmett reminded him.
"You said you were headed to the clinic."
"Oh, yeah," the man said. "Not that kind of clinic, the methadone clinic. We have to go twice a day. Reba here is trying to kick the O.C.
"The O.C.?"
Emmett asked warily. What the hell is the O.C.?
Oxycontin, I said. Working at a mental health agency, I saw these kinds of people every day. Some were harmless, but some were not. Some were people wanting help. Some were soulless leeches who used and abused their fellow man. The man cast his eyes to the Polaris.
You got that, he said, raising a finger toward it. Would you sell us some gas from it?
I shook my head. Not enough gas in there to be of any help to you. It's a small tank and it's nearly empty anyway.
I gotta get to the clinic, the girl said, raising her eyes and speaking for the first time.
I saw the desperation that I'd seen many times before in the eyes of addicts. I wondered if she was preparing to appeal to our sympathy. Substance abusers were masters of manipulation. It was a tool of their trade. I spoke to her softly, trying to be calming.
Well, the clinic may be closed for a while. Have you guys seen the news? We're under attack and things are falling apart. It may take a while to get everything going again.
We've heard about it, the man said. But life goes on. People need what they need.
I had nothing to say to that.
Can you give us a ride? The girl asked. It's probably just 25 miles or so to the clinic.
We got to go soon. If we're late, they quit dosing, and I can't get in until tomorrow.
Sorry, we're not given any rides, I said firmly. If we take you home, we're burning gas we can't replace. We came out to pick up this sick lady, and we're heading back home. She needs medical care now. We wish you good luck, but we can't help you. The clinic probably isn't even open. I doubt they can even get their methadone shipments.
The girl appeared not to hear me.
What's wrong with the old lady? The girl asked, pointing toward Ruth.
Jack, who'd worked his way from his car back to the trailer to stand at his wife's side, addressed the girl.
She had surgery. We're on our way home. She's very sick.
Jack leaned over the side of the trailer and placed the suitcase and his wife's purse in there. The girl's eyes lit up and fixed on Ruth's purse.
Surgery? Did they give her anything?
Excuse me?
Jack asked, unsure of what she meant.
What did they give her?
The girl yelled, her voice shrill.
What medication for the pain?
I stepped toward the trailer. We're not giving you any medication. I lowered a hand to my shirt tail, reaching for the grip of my Beretta. I would not pull it out unless things escalated, but I wanted it close at hand. In a blur of motion, the girl drew a flimsy steak knife from her pocket and jumped over the side of the trailer. She stuck the knife to Ruth's neck and screamed in my direction.
I will kill this bitch if you don't give me her fucking pain pills.
At the other side of the trailer, Jack lunged.
No,
he shouted, reaching for the knife with both hands. Without hesitation, the girl slashed at his grasping hands, cutting him across the forearm. A trail of blood splashed across Ruth's unconscious body, and Jack drew away from the knife, falling as he backpedaled and tumbled down the shoulder of the highway into the weeds. The girl's troubled eyes turned back to me, and I caught a brief flicker of panic before a concussive blast erupted behind me into the left. I ducked and backed away from the noise, drawing my weapon. The girl's body jerked, and she slumped backward over the tailgate of the trailer and onto the ground.
Reba!
The man screamed. He lunged for her, but another loud gunshot froze him in his tracks. It was Emmett who had fired. He was holding what looked like a nickel .357 Magnum in a single-hand grip, and it was now pointed toward the man at the end of the trailer.
We're pulling out of here, he told the man. You don't move until we're gone. If you move a damn muscle, I'll kill you, too. You killed my girlfriend, you fucking asshole, the man hissed.
Any girl who'd put a knife to a sick old lady's throat ain't worth missing, Emmett replied. Good riddance to bad rubbish. Damned if Emmett wasn't a badass after all. Gary and I ducked over the shoulder of the road and checked on Jack. The wound would require stitches, but was mostly superficial. There were no gushing arteries. I pulled a bandana from the cargo pocket on my pants and wrapped his arm tightly.
"Let's get you into the trailer," Gary said. "We've got to get out of here."
We got Jack in the trailer while Emmett kept his gun trained on the man. Once Jack was situated, Gary pulled his Glock and kept it trained on the now weeping man while Emmett lowered himself into the seat and started the Polaris. When we pulled forward, the man dropped to his dead girlfriend and began talking softly to her, shaking her as if she'd awaken and continue their desperate walk. Gary continued watching him until we were out of sight. Then he sat down in his seat. He kept the Glock in his lap, close at hand for the remainder of the ride.
"Lowlifes," Emmett muttered. "Is this what people are acting like in times of national crisis? What happened to people pulling together in a crisis? This ain't my fucking America."
"From what we've seen, this could be the new normal," I remarked. On the drive back, I remembered the circumstances under which my grandfather first told me about the violence he'd experienced in his life. I was visiting him in West Virginia with my parents and my brother. I'd been hanging out with some of the kids from the hollow he lived in, and we were playing basketball in the road. In those days, it was nothing for people in rural areas to place a goal beside the road so that the packed surface of the roadway could act as the basketball court. There was not enough traffic to be concerned about, and people couldn't drive very fast on those rough roads anyway. A scuffle broke out when one of the West Virginia boys tried to take the ball from me. He was being more aggressive than I was used to, and it led to a scuffle. He wanted to fight. I walked off with him calling me names as I left. My grandfather, who heard about it later from a neighbor, was not happy about the way I acted.
"Never show fear," he said. "Never walk off, and never let anyone know that you're afraid. They smell weakness, and they'll never let up. The world will eat you alive."
I didn't know what to say to that. The world eating me alive was a vivid and somewhat disturbing image.
"When I was 13, my grandfather told me, my sister Lou was 12. I was working in the mines already, but Lou was in school. She came home one day and was all upset, crying, and wouldn't talk to no one. Mom found out later from one of the other girls that there was a boy at school saying mean things about her. I found out from one of my friends that there was this boy at school telling everyone that Lou let him touch her. You know what I'm saying, right? Well, I knew my sister, and I knew there was no way it was true, but the boy who said this was 17 and big as any man around these parts. I knew that if I went after him directly, I'd get my ass whipped, maybe even killed."
My grandfather, who smoked Pall Malls, lit one up at that point, and his eyes shifted from me to the wooded hillside, and I knew he was going back there in his head. The memory was fresh enough that he could walk back inside it like a familiar room.
"So this boy, his name was Jake, walked home each day from school down a trail by the Tug Fork River. He got off school about the same time I got off work at the mines. I had this little pump-action Stevens .22 rifle that I used for squirrels and rabbits, and I hid it in the woods in a hollow tree where I could get to it quick after I got off my shift. I'd get the rifle and run to this little rocky bluff that looked out over the path that Jake walked. The first day I just fired off a shot in the air, not even close to him, just a shot to make him wonder who was shooting and what they were shooting at. Next day I caught him in a different spot, and I barked a tree just off the path he was walking. That got his attention."
My grandfather put his feet up on the porch rail. His voice was hypnotic in the West Virginia evening, the air a soup of musty river smell and humidity. No traffic moved on the road in front of his house. The world was still, only the two of us in its entirety.
"Each day I'd catch him at a different spot and shoot closer than the day before. I could tell he was getting nervous from the way he walked, the way he hesitated before each step. One day I shot a hole in his lunch bucket, swinging in his hand while he walked. The next I shot the top right off a pop bottle he was carrying in his hand. He pissed his pants that time, and I knew I'd made my point.
The next day, that boy comes to the house and he apologizes to my sister. I was on the porch and never spoke a word to the boy, but he made eye contact with me, and I knew his eyes were saying that we were square now and that I shouldn't have reason to keep shooting at him. I never told anyone what I was doing, but I guess he must have figured out that it weren't no coincidence that the shooting started about the same time as my sister came home crying. "Why didn't he just tell someone?" I asked him. He knew what we all knew then, that a man's problems are his own to solve. You don't put them off on other people to fix for you. If a man wrongs you, it's between you and that man, not between you and the law and him. In the mountains, we take care of things ourselves. That boy knew that he had wronged me, and he had to make it right, or one of those bullets would eventually find its way into his head. My mom only heard the last part of this conversation, and she did not approve. She loved her dad, but did not want us growing up in the middle of that way of life. She did not care for feuds and fights and blood vendettas, which was why she moved away to go to college and never came back. Thinking of my mom made me wonder how they were doing. I was hoping that my wife and kids would check on them, maybe even bring them out to our house if they'd be willing to come. When we got to our exit, Emmett drove the ATV toward the church tents. Since we were the only thing moving under gas power at this time, we attracted a lot of attention passing by the crowds of stalled travelers. The convenience store drunks were still drinking, and there was a little more staggering and obvious drunkenness than when we'd walked in earlier. "You're going to have trouble out of these folks here," I told Emmett. "No shit," he replied. "I'm expecting a fight to break out any minute. I hope they keep it among themselves and leave us out of it. Let them kill each other off." Before we reached the church tents, Emmett stopped in the road and addressed Gary and I in a low voice. "I would like to keep that little incident on the road just between us," he said. "You all know I didn't have a choice about shooting that girl, but I don't want folks second-guessing me. It's a small community here." We all nodded. "Fine with me, Emmett," I said. "I'll speak with Jack when we reach the tents. I know he's grateful, so I'm sure he'll keep his mouth shut, too." We continued up the road a little further, and when we approached the tents, I could hear the sound of loud voices. Emmett pulled the ATV into the shade of a large maple tree off to the side. Randy, who was apparently already at the food tent, came walking quickly toward us with an older lady in tow who was carrying a first aid kit. "This is Bonnie," she said. "She's a nurse practitioner." The two women approached the trailer, and Bonnie immediately began providing aid to Ruth. She fired questions at Jack, and he answered them, although he was obviously glazed over from exhaustion and perhaps in a little shock. He stood cradling his injured arm and looking very tired. I pulled Randy to the side. "What's going on over there?" Gary and Emmett walked up to us about that time and stood by, as anxious as I was, to find out what all the noise at the food tent was about. "There are a bunch of damn drunks who want fed. The minister said he wasn't feeding them. They started getting all mouthy, and Rebecca intervened, trying to keep the peace. Now they're all pissed at her and the minister, and things are getting a little heated." "It was only a matter of time," Emmett said. "You know those damn dopers can't sit down there all day smoking their marijuana and having to smell cooking hamburgers. Eventually, something would have to give. Potheads." "I think there's going to be a fight," Randy commented. "I've been in brawls before. This is how they start." I raised an eyebrow at her. Obviously, this girl had a more entertaining life than she let on at work. Bonnie, the nurse practitioner, interrupted. She took Emmett by the arm and said in a low voice, "We're going to have to take her to the hospital. She needs fluids." "I thought they weren't letting anyone through to town," Gary asked. "They'll make an exception for a medical emergency, I think," Bonnie replied. "Let's move it, though. She's in a fragile state." "I'm going to tell the deputies at the roadblock to keep an eye on this situation," Emmett said. "We don't need a bunch of people getting killed for trying to help people." I wasn't sure that calling the cops would help anything, but these were Emmett's people here, and if that's what he thought he should do, I wasn't going to tell him otherwise. We all shook hands, wished each other luck, and Emmett drove off.
Gary and I approached the tents. Inside, we could see a large cluster of people with an opening in the center, where Rebecca and the minister were faced off against a half-dozen loud and angry-looking Hispanics. There was a lot of gesturing on both sides, and it was hard to tell what was